presentation of A Novel Idea on KRCB is made possible by our members and by SolarWorks, reminding you that SolarWorks offers public going solar workshops to answer all your questions about solar electricity. More information at solarworksca.com.
Just wait, the whitey may roam. Always a hero comes home. He goes when no one has gone, but always a hero comes home.
These were hard times, heartbreaking for the Prince of the Shieldings. Powerful counselors, the highest in the land, would lend advice, plotting how best the bold defenders might resist and beat off sudden attacks. Sometimes at pagan shrines they vowed offerings to idols, swore oaths that the killer of souls might come to their aid and save the people. That was their way, their heathenish hope. Deep in their hearts, they remembered hell. The almighty judge of good deeds and the bad, the Lord God, head of the heavens and high king of the world, was unknown to them. Oh, cursed is he who in time of trouble has to thrust his soul in the fire's embrace, forfeiting help. So that troubled time continued, woe that never stopped, steady affliction of Halfdane's son, too hard an ordeal. There was panic after dark. People endured raids in the night, riven by the terror. When he heard about Grendel, Hygelac's thane was on home ground over in Geatland. There was no one else like him alive. In his day he was the mightiest man on earth, high-born and powerful. He ordered a boat that would ply the waves. He announced his plan to sail the Swan's Road and search out that king, the famous prince who needed defenders. Nobody tried to keep him from going. No elder denied him, dear as he was to them. Instead, they inspected omens and spurred his ambition to go, whilst he moved about like the leader he was, enlisting men, the best he could find. With 14 others, the warrior boarded the boat as captain, a canny pilot along coasts and currents. Time went by. The boat was on the water, in close under the cliffs. Men climbed eagerly up the gangplank. Sand churned in surf. Warriors loaded a cargo of weapons, shining war gear in the vessel's hold, then heaved out, away with a will in their wood-wreathed ship. Over the waves, with the wind behind her and foam at her neck, she flew like a bird until her curved prow had covered the distance, and on the following day, at the due hour, those seafarers sighted land, sunlit cliffs, sheer crags and looming headlands, the windfall they sought. It was the end of their voyage, and the Geats vaulted over the side, out onto the sand, and moored their ship. There was a clash of mail and a thresh of gear. They thanked God for that easy crossing on a calm sea.
When no one has gone, but always a hero.
That was Terry Arrett reading from Beowulf. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. Terry is a well-known local poet and teacher and is always so active in the promotion of literature and especially poetry. And I'm so thrilled to have you in the studio today, Terry.
My great pleasure, Rosemary. Thank you.
Yes. And Beowulf, I bet many of our listeners haven't encountered that name since A Course in World Lit.
Very likely. They haven't encountered it at all unless they've been paying attention to recent films, because Beowulf has had a very interesting resurgence in film of late. Or perhaps they had some exposure to it in junior high or high school. Usually not very pleasant. And I think what surprised the people that that worked with me at the Sitting Room last fall and through this spring in the study of Beowulf was just how beautiful the language was and how relevant the story for our times right now.
The new translation probably has a lot
Seamus Heaney's 1999 translation, which I think may have been the only time Beowulf has ever been on the bestseller list, New York Times bestseller list, and stayed there for quite a while. And I'm sure that that had quite a bit to do with a resurgence of interest, because his translation, which I was reading from, makes the language so accessible and the poem so much more human than I'd ever encountered it before.
And the language is beautiful.
It's hard to tell in that passage I read, which is one of my favorite moments in the in the epic, how much of the energy of that poetry is Seamus Heaney's and how much is the original Anglo-Saxon. But I have a feeling it was there in the original, and Heaney just knew how to honor that.
A few days ago, Terry was in the studio with her students, the Beowulf scholars.
Yes, we call ourselves the Beowulfians, who this rather eclectic group of women who decided that they wanted to make this a course of study and wanted also to see what the reading of this Old English epic might do to inspire their own writing.
And we're going to hear a conversation with the Beowulfians and some examples of their own response in writing to the Beowulf epic. We'll hear that in just a few moments. So let me give the names of the Beowulfians. These are the Beowulf scholars: Rose Black, Donna Emerson, Catherine Hart, Elsa Rossiger, Maggie Tutur, Susan Starbird, and Patrice Warrender. And you'll be hearing from them shortly. Terry, it's amazing, this new movie about Beowulf, the Robert Zemeckis movie.
The
you've
one
seen
that
it,
came
course.
Out in November of 2007. Yes.
Yes.
In fact, the Beowulfians went together to see the Beowulf when it opened at the Petaluma Cinemas, opening day, matinee. There were eight of us, all middle-aged women, most of us gray-haired. Went into the theater, got our 3D goggles, went in. There was hardly a soul there. And there we were, the young men who were working the counter must have thought, what is going on? Because, of course, the film was really designed to appeal to a younger audience and probably a male audience.
Yes. And what was your impression?
Well, one of the interesting things about the film adaptations, I don't really expect them to follow the story, because in the tradition of the Anglo-Saxon tradition of the shaper, every telling is a different shaping and it serves a different purpose because it speaks to a different audience. So every film adaptation has a different way of telling the story, or even may tell a different kind of story. But that probably has been going on since the first time the story was shaped by the first Anglo-Saxon poet who put it into language. Zemeckis' version was really more of, I think, a technological extravaganza. And so those who are interested in that kind of live-action animation would certainly find it interesting. And then there was the 3D aspect of it. For my part, the only thing that really grabbed me was that this was a very different portrayal of the relationship between the kings and the monsters, Grendel and the Fire Dragon, and a very different portrayal of Grendel's mother.
I should
She's
say so.
Not the she-hag of
That's right.
Previous interpretations, but kind of Lady of the Lake seductress.
Yes.
And what interested me about that is it gave us a different transformation of what is essentially the mother archetype, who can sometimes take the form of a dragon, and sometimes take the form of a hag, and sometimes the form of a seductress, depending on her, you know, the role she's playing. And it was also interesting to me because there are some scholars who believe that Grendel's mother and Grendel, whether they're a tribe of people or a mother and son team, may represent the pre-Britain civilization that would have engaged in human sacrifice from about 1200 on, engaged in human sacrifice, and their ceremonies were often held on the shores of lakes and bogs, and probably gave rise to the idea of the monster that the hero has to go and slay, and the mother would have been the fertility goddess of the earth who would receive the sacrifice. So the film plays with that in an interesting way, and I don't know how many people going to see it would have appreciated that take on Grendel's mother, but you know, the group of eight of us sitting in the middle of this practically empty theater with our 3D goggles, that's what we came out talking about.
I think that some of those aspects of Grendel's mother are in John Gardner's book, Grendel. Do I remember that correctly?
John Gardner's book is fascinating.
Yes,
We also studied that as well as looking at the various film adaptations. We read John Gardner's novel came out in the 70s. It's told from the point of view of Grendel.
Yes.
And his mother is kind of a, she still has a kind of she-hag quality to her, mm-hmm. Certainly not the seductress. And she's unable to speak language. Grendel is fascinated by the human ability to speak language and is drawn to them and to their mead hall and the telling of tales and the singing of songs for that reason. He's fascinated by it, and he's also tormented by the way human beings can use language to change reality, and finds it so deeply disturbing that he has to go and stop it from happening. So when he hears the shaper telling the tales, singing the tales, it drives him nearly mad until he goes and stops them dead in their tracks, or has them for lunch, or whatever he decides to do with them.
So Gardner, in a sense, is exploring motivation.
Exploring motivation, exploring that role of the shaper, uh-huh. and the distinctly human relationship to language uh-huh. and consciousness. And for Grendel, it's a power that he longs for and is envious of. But it terrifies him because it keeps undoing his reality. And his relationship with Beowulf, Beowulf at the moment when they struggle,
yes.
and he has his arm ripped off and he eventually bleeds to death. The struggle is to hold on to his reality and his perception of it and not have it changed out from under him by Beowulf, who is muttering in his ear a different version of reality.
I see. Then there was another movie not that long ago, Beowulf and Grendel,
yeah.
the Sturla Gunnarsson movie.
Sturla Gunnarsson made, I think, perhaps one of the best adaptations of Beowulf. But you have to know a little something about what Gunnarsson was up to. And I will say that both Robert Zemeckis and Sturla Gunnarsson loved the tale of Beowulf from the time they were boys and wanted to make this film adaptation, knowing that it could have the same kind of appeal to audiences that Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and the film adaptation of the Iliad, the Hollywood adaptation called Troy. I mean, those were big successes, and I think they thought that this epic could have that same kind of appeal. But how do you tell that story that you love so much? For Gunnarsson, he was interested in who Beowulf might have really been, who his band of warriors might have really been, who Grendel might have really been, and how did the myth and the legend grow up around what might have been a very human band of warriors. Zemeckis does something very different, and he goes grand scale and creates monsters that can't exist in this world at all, can only exist really in CG animation. Very different ways of representing the story. So what's interesting in Sturla Gunnarsson's, besides the fact that it's filmed in Iceland, which is just scenically majestic, the things that interested me in his film adaptation was we see Beowulf engage in a reasonably interesting battle. And then we watch his shaper, his storyteller who's with him, who's one of his band of warriors, spin it right before our eyes into a mythic version of what has just happened. It kind of reverses the roles that we see of Grendel and Beowulf in John Gardner's novel, where Grendel is so terrified of having his reality shape-shifted from under him. Beowulf gets angry as he sees his shaper manipulating and twisting and conjuring up a mythic version of himself as he's standing right there. Throughout the film, we get to see the epic evolving. It even goes from being a pagan epic to a Christian epic as the shaper converts to Christianity.
Yes, I was interested in the references to Christianity and wondering if those were had originally been there or if someone later...
Yeah, when did the Christian commentary, some of which was included in what I read earlier, how much of that was originally there? That's very hard to say because the tale would have been told so many times by yes. many different shapers, some of them Christian and some not so Christian. And how much of it might have been recorded by the Christian monks who did eventually write it down. Very hard to say. I think scholars take different stands on that. But the feeling of the epic is not essentially a Christian story.
Yes.
And that's not to say it's anti-Christian. It's just that its roots are older.
Yes.
And they're rooted in a world which is more about the human relationship to the elements and
yes.
to fate.
Terry, as I listen to you, I'm just so impressed of you as an interpreter and a teacher because I watched those movies and essentially I missed the point of both of them.
I think that's easy to do. What got me interested in teaching a Beowulf workshop in the first place was that 2005 Sturla Gunnarsson version of the film. And I got it from my husband, who's a Beowulf buff, Anglo-Saxon scholar, which I was not. He loves the Beowulf epic. And I brought the DVD home for him. And he fell asleep and I watched it and I was just really taken with the way the myth evolves out of these human lives and with the portrayal of Grendel as a kind of Sasquatch kind of figure, but human. There was
yes.
a humanity in him which the film tried to capture.
Interesting. Then there's a third movie called The 13th Warrior.
There is. That was based on a Michael Crichton novel, which was written, I think, around 1976, called The Eaters of the Dead. That was its original title.
And is that based on Beowulf as well?
Well, apparently Michael Crichton, like Robert Zemeckis and Sturla Gunnarsson, was a big Beowulf fan. And he was convinced that this story could be told in a way that would not bore people. He had a bet with a friend that he could tell the story of Beowulf in a way that was not boring, and he wrote The Eaters of the Dead to prove it. What he did, though, was he told the story of Beowulf. He jumped ahead several centuries. He set it in the 10th century, and he told it from the point of view of an Arab poet, and I guess you might call him a diplomat, who is out on these diplomatic errands on the very edges of the Arab world. And he encounters a band of Norsemen who would have been called probably the Rus, the original Russians, somewhere along the Volga River. And they have been, this band of Norsemen have been summoned back home to come to the rescue of the king who's being troubled by these barbaric people, and they need a 13th warrior, and so they pull this Arab traveler. Now, he actually really existed, and in fact kept journals of his encounters with the Norse in the 10th century, and Crichton researched this fellow's work and incorporated much of his journals right into the novel itself. And when the film adaptation was made of it, they changed the title from The Eaters of the Dead to The 13th Warrior.
Well, yes.
And the book then was re-released under the title The 13th Warrior. That's very different from either of the other adaptations because in Michael Crichton's version, there isn't a Grendel. There's a race of people, the Wendel, and they are some kind of vestige of the Neanderthals who have somehow survived on the fringes of human civilization. that's sort of a Jurassic Park kind of twist to the Beowulf story. And so it's a people that are attacking. And their mother is the mother goddess that they worship. And when Beowulf has to slay Grendel's mother, it's the priestess who represents the goddess that he must slay. And there's a really interesting visual clue to that, because when they find the emblem of the Wendel, it's something that looks very much like the Venus of Willendorf, which is the a Cro-Magnon era representation of the Earth goddess. So there's a really interesting way of interpreting the Grendel Beowulf story as perhaps something that goes really far back in our human history or prehistory or maybe even our biological memory, perhaps of that conflict between Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal that resulted in the extinction of the other. Something of that perhaps is also at the heart of the Cain and Abel story, which is certainly evoked over and over again in the Beowulf tale.
And so the story is an ancient story that survived for a long time, but for centuries.
Right.
Well, it's time we took a break, so let's take a short break, and when we come back, you'll hear the conversation that Terry and I had with the Beowulfians, with the Beowulf scholars. So we'll be right back. I would have loved to have been in this course with you, but I had a conflict. But if you ever teach the course again, I'm going to be there.
Oh, that's great.
You play such an important role in the literary life of Sonoma County, and you've won a number of awards, and you have a national reputation as a poet, essayist, writer of fiction and reviews. Your books include Lost Body, Travel, How We Go On Living, Translations from the Human Language, and your latest, your absolutely brand new book, Lucky Break, of which you have just given me a copy, and I'm so pleased to have it. Is the book in the bookstores already?
It is. It hit the bookstores March 1st, and you can get a hold of it by going to any of the readings that are coming up. You can also get a hold of it in any of your local bookstores, which is where I would like to send people.
Yes.
And through our website as well.
Through your website. Terry, your website is a very good way for people to get to know you. Would you give some directions to that website?
Sure. It's very simple. It's www.terryerret.com.
And it's E-H-R-E-T.
That's
for those of you who do not yet know Terry. And you can also find it by simply Googling Terry Arrett. And there it is. Terry's always a wonderful source of information on what's going on in the county, in the literary life of the county. So you can get on her mailing list, and you'll never have to wonder again what you should be doing this evening. The women in your Beowulf class, whom I think of as the Beowulf scholars, are all accomplished writers. I'm interested in how this project came about, and we have Elsa Rosiger and Patrice Warrender on mic right now, and perhaps they'd share their stories of the project. And Terry, was it your idea in the beginning to do Beowulf?
Well, I suppose ideas are out there in the air, and who they happen to come through is always a mystery to me. But what happened was I rented the 2005 film adaptation of Beowulf. That's Sturlar Gunnarsson's adaptation. And it drew me back to Seamus Heaney's translation, which I had not read. That was published in 1999. And I happened to be married to someone who is something of an a linguist and an Anglo-Saxon scholar. And my husband and I went to dinner at Patrice's house with her and her husband, and we got to talking about Beowulf and its relevance. And before we knew it, Patrice and I had in mind that maybe there ought to be a workshop where other writers interested in reading Beowulf again and thinking about this work, we'd be able to get together, and we would do that once a week.
Yeah.
So that's how the workshop got off the ground. Mm-hmm.
And Patrice, what was it that drew you to Beowulf?
Well, Terry started talking about the movie, and if you've never heard Terry describe a movie, I mean, you really get a whole feel for the movie. So that was a gripping thing right there to go on to. But I hadn't studied Beowulf since high school. I hadn't, you know, I read it in high school. I can't really say I studied it. And I'm sure I had no real appreciation of it from that time. I'm really into relearning what I didn't learn when I was supposedly taught it, you know, years ago. And the movie sounded so exciting. And then Terry talking about the story. And then my husband and I rented the movie that week. I was really taken with it. I was taken with the narrative, the journey of Beowulf, the underlying fatalism and sense of destiny of Beowulf in the movie. And as we started to read it, the language totally seduced me. It was wonderful.
And you are a poet, so you would have the appreciation for the poetry.
Yes. And the poem I'm going to read uses a lot of the elements from Anglo-Saxon. There are Anglo-Saxon words embedded in my poem, and there are what are called kennings. Kennings are two words that are used to make a third word. The word hoard, H-O-A-R-D, is to hold on to something. But if you use word hoard, it is the words that we use personally. So this is heard throughout the poem. And my poem is from the point of view of Beowulf's old poet, who has been with him for many, many years. This is called Winter Song. The glead is stingy with its warm this night. My fingers yield not with ease to stroke my harp, my joy wood, and my breast hoard stirs untidy. Listen. The wind blows rough across the nest, howling like the loath mirwife or her bastard bairn. 50 winters passed that battle fought and won, and still I shiver to hear its echo in the wind. Who can sing to such accompaniment? Even the great timbers of the mead hall shudder at the sound. Yet I seek to serve my lord, so I strum my harp and sing of the rider of the sea who sailed his seawood on the mere Aisne. I remember well when first I sang his praise in Hrothgar's court, Beowulf, savior of Danes, now Geatland's greatest king. He sits quiet among his thanes tonight, furs wound tight gainst lick of cold, his mead cup left untouched. What is it that furrows his brow and holds him close? Only his eyes move, casting about the hall. Before I can look away, his gaze nets mine, and my joy wood stumbles at what I see in the blue mirror of his eyes, a warrior weary, his craft an ebbing tide. My voice box drops to a whisper, and I give struggle to cheer a tune, a battle parle and daring do from days when we were young. His lips part in almost smile. He lifts his cup to me. The sleep night brings me no rest. My dream's been of dragon blood and bale and valor in the reek. I dream Beowulf and the tiled worm, fierce together bound in terror's grip, share the fourth way home, strange companions, and bright bale fire built to warm our good king's bones. I wake to dawn scorched red by heaven's jewel and a ringing clash of mail. The end begins.
Elsa, did you grow up in Denmark?
Yes, I did. Yes. And, well, that wasn't really the motivation for starting Beowulf, learning about Beowulf. I had wanted to work with Terry again for a long time, and when she offered the Beowulf class, I signed immediately and then wondered, why in the world am I doing this? And, of course, I knew there was such a thing as Beowulf, but I had no real knowledge of it. But as soon as we got into the text of it, I also began to learn a lot about my own cultural heritage that I had no real, I wouldn't say I didn't have any knowledge of it, but it was just focused in a different way, and that became very fascinating. So through the class and through also the research one can do at the internet these days, it is a really amazing experience to learn about these things.
Ilse, why do you think that this interest in, I mean, it's a very, very old story. Why do you think the contemporary interest in the story of Beowulf?
I think that this epic story that was told so many centuries ago was really is really information that is very relevant today, in the sense that it has furthered my own understanding of storytelling in history and of myth, and it also sheds a lot of light on psychological questions that are inherent in human nature. It informs us about the nature of politics and power, and it, in the end, it really adds to our own understanding of ourselves. And I think that's why it's so fascinating. It does. It works on so many levels.
Yes, and the dark side of human nature seems to come out in this story.
Yeah, I think the shadow side of our lives and of very current political issues, I think it's fascinating how you can just to look at it, and particularly with in the poem, there is a shaper, there's somebody that tells the story. As soon as things happen, somebody tells the story, and then you immediately see that it get embellished, it gets changed immediately, and that you can just look at the PR people we have in our political system, you know, it's just the same thing. The story gets shaped immediately, yes, to something maybe other than what actually happened, and that's very fascinating. So it becomes very relevant in that way. Yes. Helps us understand the dimensions of political power.
Yes, it's a surprisingly contemporary story.
Yes, it is.
Did it? How do you feel about it, Terry? Did that fact that it seems to reflect contemporary events?
Yeah. Well, what I was drawn to in the story were the psychological aspects of it, particularly how we demonize our enemies, how we project our own shadow selves onto our enemies, and don't always address the shadow element in ourselves as a result of that. And so we continue to get caught in that cycle. So I was a little more interested in the psychological component to it. But I think as a culture that is at this moment facing the possibility of extinction, there's a lot of relevance in this epic, which is about a people that comes to the end of its time. At the end of, with Beowulf's death, the Geats will be scattered and in exile, and it's the end of the world for them. And I think there's something of that resonance and that doom that certainly connects with where we are right now historically. From my husband's point of view, when I asked him, why is Beowulf relevant now, you think? Why so many film adaptations? Why so much attention? And he thought it had something to do with having to redefine the hero. Yes. And that in the same way that Ken Burns' wonderful series about World War II did not glorify war, it was a very powerful anti-war kind of piece, but it looked at individual experiences within that as heroic. That is exactly what the Beowulf epic does. The Geats are not heroes. The Swedes are not enemies. The Danes are not heroes. And it doesn't work that way. But within those tribes and kingdoms, the nobility of the individual is heroic. And that's a different way of thinking about it.
And the universal longing when we're in trouble to have a hero come in from the outside and save us. And to me, that was part of the universality of this story. Beowulf, come and save us.
Well, Beowulf represents as a hero what we hope we can be, what we hope we can rise to. So it draws our higher nature out of us. And likewise, the shadow is how the hero defines himself against that which he fights against, but is also what we fear most that we might be or feel most shamed by or terrorized by in our own lives.
So are you saying that we must be our own heroes?
Well, I think that's the point of the hero legends from a Jungian and Joseph Campbell perspective. The hero legend is really a teaching story that tells us how to live meaningfully in the world, how to find one's own inner moral compass, your own inner source of being, and to act from that source of being rather than having one's purpose in life defined by external sources. And that's the root of every hero story.
Okay. For most of our listeners, Beowulf may be a familiar name from English courses. But let's do a little bit of a refresher course in history. What do we know about the manuscript? Terry?
The manuscript was probably first written by two different scribes, Christian monks who wrote it down sometime around 1000 AD. But the historical events that are depicted in the epic probably date to around 500 AD. It would be about the same time as the historical King Arthur with the Britons. These events would have been happening in southern Sweden and Denmark. We know that Beowulf's lord, Hygelac, dies, according to the Franks' historical records, in about 531. So we've got some historical pinpoint. And probably right after that would have been the time when the Shapers began to tell Beowulf's story and make it into legend. It was passed from generation to generation as part of an oral tradition until the 8th century, when it may have first been transcribed, and then the document that we know of in 1000 or thereabouts. As far as I know, it wasn't much read, didn't get much attention. It fell eventually in the hands of a rare book collector. His name was Sir Robert Cotton. And when he passed away, his collection of rare books was housed in, ironically, a place called Ashburnham House, which caught fire and burned, and most of the library was lost in 1731. Miraculously, Beowulf was saved from the fire, singed around the edges, but in very bad shape, and it took about another century before the manuscript was transcribed, because the pages were crumbling, and translated. It was the Danish government that funded that, believe it or not. And it took about 100 years before it was finally in the hands of English scholars. So it's a fairly late addition to the English canon of literature. It did not really become a part of the study of English students until the second half of the 19th century.
Makes you wonder what else was lost.
Much was lost. And the same is true also, the same kind of story of its late arrival in the canon of English literature, of the Exeter Book, which is the other great source for Anglo-Saxon lyrics and riddles.
Mm-hmm. And where is the manuscript now?
The manuscript is in the British Museum, and it lives there under good care.
Can one see it?
Sure. If you make a trip over to London, make a stop to the British Museum, you'll see that and many other really wonderful things. But that's where it's living now.
It must be quite thrilling. I'm interested in J.R.R. Tolkien's role in bringing this story back into, popular knowledge, at least to get it going.
Yeah, I think Tolkien's influence is really interesting because he was a philologist, a scholar, a linguist, wrote the Middle English Dictionary, mm-hmm. and was busy teaching students to translate Beowulf. Mm-hmm. He had a difficult time with it because the translations done at the time were language-based. The document was seen as something of a historical artifact, but not a poem, not a work of literature. And Tolkien published in 1936 a really important essay called Beowulf, the Monster and the Critics, in which he insisted on looking at that work as a well-crafted piece of poetry. And I think it was the first time that the study of Beowulf moved out of that part of the study of English which is historical linguistics and moved into the canon of literature itself. That was Tolkien's contribution. He was also the writer, of course, of popular fantasy, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings series, mm-hmm. based a lot of what was in those books on the Beowulf and other lyrics of the time. So you get a word like orc, which comes right out of the Anglo-Saxon lexicon. You get Aragorn's famous The Song of Rohan from the second book is actually lifted right from The Wanderer, which is one of the lyric poems of the Anglo-Saxon era in the Exeter book. He clearly based the dragon Smaug in The Hobbit, a slightly gentler version of the fire dragon that Beowulf battles at the end of that epic. And even down to it's the Hobbit who steals, Bilbo who steals the chalice that enrages and awakens the dragon, and the same event happens at the end of Beowulf as well. So he was pulling on that tradition very consciously in forming his popular literature. But those people who were falling in love with The Lord of the Rings in the 1960s were not necessarily going back to Beowulf as the source. And it really didn't happen, I think, until Peter Jackson's remaking of the Lord of the Rings in a film adaptation that took people, as he was taken back to the origins of Tolkien's work, other people have followed suit. And that probably has a lot to do with the resurgence of interest in Beowulf right now.
Brought people's attention to the universality of the story and the fact that people all over the world would go to see The Lord of the Rings.
That's right. Uh-huh. It made it contemporary, and it took something that had otherwise a life for scholars into the world of popular culture.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rose and Donna, I want you to feel free to comment at any time.
I wanted to say that when I first read Beowulf in high school, which was 1960, it was an older translation. It was regarded as that dull epic, and it was a drag to go through. And most of us in high school didn't look forward to that English class where we studied it. But what drew me to this class with Terry this time was the fact that we were going to read Seamus Heaney's translation, which is so much lighter and lilting. And in the words of the working people of Ireland, it seemed to me, the way he speaks and the way he tells it, that I wanted to hear his voice. I wanted to hear his interpretation. And it's been an entirely different experience.
I would agree that hearing Seamus Heaney's voice was absolutely spectacular. It was just amazing. And in the introduction, he writes about his connection with the Anglo-Saxon, his own personal connection with the Anglo-Saxon. He said that he recognized certain words in the manuscript that he had heard his grandmother use, words that would not be a common to Americans. So I feel that there was a direct link from Seamus Heaney back to the Anglo-Saxon. I was just amazed. I have been commuting to Terry's workshops from Oakland, so it's a long commute, and I have a tape of Seamus Heaney's Beowulf that I've been playing back and forth every single time I've made the ride. And it's been delightful.
I hope that some of our listeners will be inspired to get that tape. And I think to hear any poet reading his own work, his or her own work, gives it a very personal feeling for the listener.
It felt very authentic.
Yes.
And the alliteration in Beowulf is so delicious, and the alliteration is, you know, the consonant alliteration which comes on the accented syllables. Is that correct, Terry?
Yes.
and there, you could also say that the vowels are alliterative. Is that
right.
True?
Well, technically, we call that assonance.
Assonance, yes. Exactly. Sure. And here, this is a little four-line rhyme. It's homophonic, but I was so taken with the alliteration and the sound of Beowulf composed this. It's a nonsense rhyme. In Parley Place the proud was reed, all reek and rich beseen. The scathe of Scop Gree height that night, the trolls swink stark and teen. You know, it's those kinds of sounds that just go right through you, you
they
know.
Do.
And it's been a such a rewarding experience.
Language is so powerful.
Well, that has something of the Jabberwocky, Lewis yes. Carroll's Jabberwocky, which in fact draws pretty much directly from the Anglo-Saxon in its lexicon as well.
He was a scholar as well, wasn't he?
Sure was.
Yes, he wrote more than
he was a Cambridge Don. Mathematics was his field, actually.
Yes. Fascinating.
Okay. For me, when I hear Seamus Heaney reading, I feel like I'm an adult being lulled to sleep by a wonderful story, a wonderful poem, and his sort of his wet words. They just make you feel whole. It's an amazing experience.
You know, we haven't talked much about the plot of Beowulf, and I know there are many of our listeners who are quite familiar with it, but for those who may not have read it since English Lit 101 or who may never even have heard of Beowulf, I wonder if you talk a little bit about the story itself. Terry?
Sure. Well, I can deliver the plot in a kind of thumbnail. Historically, we're set somewhere around 500 A.D., and this Geat warrior, Geatland is southern Sweden, the very tip of southern Sweden, sails across the narrow stretch of sea. Elsa tells me you could almost throw a stone across it at its narrowest section, to Denmark. And he's come to the aid of his father's friend, King Hrothgar. Hrothgar and his Danes have been troubled by a flesh-eating monster called Grendel. Beowulf fights the monster and kills him. But the mother comes to avenge her son's death, and Beowulf has to slay her too. Once he's done that, he's rescued the Danes from their nightmare. He travels back to Geatland, eventually rises to the position of king, and rules in peace for 50 years. But at the end of his life, Beowulf's peaceful reign is disturbed by the appearance of a fire dragon who is awakened accidentally from his sleep guarding a hoard, probably a burial hoard of gold and treasures. And Beowulf has to battle the dragon to protect his people. He dies eventually from a poisoned wound that is poisoned by the dragon's venom. And when the hero and dragon die, they are laid out side by side, self and shadow, so to speak. And then the poem ends with the hero's burial and a lament for the people who realize now that without their leader, they are going to soon be pillaged, scattered, and exiled. It's the end of their world.
Amazing story. One of the things that strikes me is there are not very many good parts in there for women. And now your class consists of women poets, so I'd like to
know. We're all women. It was part of the excitement of teaching a class like this because the point of entry to any story is usually identifying with the protagonist. And if your protagonist is a warrior hero, it may be harder for women to find their entry into the work that way. But there are plenty of women haunting the fringes of the story, stalking the outskirts like Grendel. Including Grendel's mother, including the queen, Wealhtheow, Hrothgar's wife, but other women who are mentioned. And so part of what we wanted to do was to flesh out those roles of the women and try to imagine the story shaped from the point of view of the women in it.
Mm-hmm. And could we hear a little bit about how some of you did that, Susan?
Well, the poem that I wrote is a trilogy, and the first character in it is Ursel, who's the sister of Hrothgar. And there's a very brief mention of her near the beginning of the poem where it says that she was bartered to King Onela of Sweden, and that's pretty much at the point at which she disappears from the story.
Right. She's the balm in bed for the battle-scarred king.
Ooh, talk about alliteration.
Yes. And the middle part of my poem is the sea hag's lament after her son Grendel has been killed. And then the latter part is a meditation by Queen Wealhtheow.
What a wonderful experience to reach into the story itself and pluck out the characters and then to flesh them out in your own way.
Well, it was really fun to imagine myself as the sea hag. You know, she's been depicted so dramatically in on film, but also to find that place within myself where I could have that the insane rage and passion that a mother would feel when her child is taken from her.
Well, I too was captured by the sea hag, and I lived the whole story through it. When I began writing, I had pages and pages about this character, and that she was really the witness of the end of that civilization, that Grendel really did try and incorporate some of the Vikings' ways and lost his own, so that his mother didn't have the words to speak to him that would make sense. He kind of fell in the cracks. And so she was the one that I really loved the most, but she had no power except to witness and love and grieve.
That explains what I sensed in, I think it was in John Gardner's Grendel, that was that where he was unable to communicate with his mother, that, mm-hmm. that she had no language for him. I thought it was an interesting twist on the story of Grendel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think I was inspired to write one of my poems in regards to images of Grendel and bringing Grendel into the 21st century as opposed to seeing him then. I think he was there, but I also, as the story went, I had no idea who Beowulf was when I came into the workshop. So it was very new to me, and even reading Anglo-Saxon was another world for me. And I have to say that the sea hag was very inspiring too, and I wrote another poem in regards to where the sea hag was in a story form. I think the women are there in strength. You read it, you feel it, but it's always the male archetype that takes over first, and then you see the underlying parts of the female who's guiding everything.
Very good. I noticed also in the story that there were certain references to Christianity, and that was a little surprising to me. You know, one gets a little lost in time that far back and during the first century AD. And I wondered if, the monks were transcribing it. I wondered if some of those monks added their own little notations and brought in some of their own, here's a chance to get in a good word for religion at this point. I mean, is that a great stretch, or do you think something like that might possibly have happened?
Yeah, it wasn't written down for three or four centuries, and then by the time it was written down by the monks. So there's this Christian edge that always seems to me, kind of superficial and flagging.
I think it kind of set up that little notion in my brain too, that this might have been some. There might be a little spin here. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about the way the bards put a spin on Terry.
Well, I wanted to say that that's something that Sturla Gunnarsson, the director of the 2005 Grendel and Beowulf film adaptation, explores, because he has the shaper, the storyteller, there on the spot being converted to Christianity. And you watch the transformation of his telling of the story before he's Christian and how he begins to insert the Christian references and explanations and his spin on it, much to Beowulf's alarm and anger that it suddenly takes on this other meaning. And I think that's a really interesting way to imagine how the role of the shaper and the shaper's point of view can influence it. Of course, those Christian monks who were actually writing it down had an opportunity to shape it as well and to give it their spin. And for me, what was really interesting was what happens if you have, perhaps for the first time, women shapers, as the women in my workshop were able to do, put their spin on the story. And each one of it tells its truth in a different way.
There, just to clarify, in the olden times, there were probably no women bards, women shapers. Am I correct?
As far as we know, the role of women in Anglo-Saxon society didn't include bard. Mm-hmm. They were the those who threaded the peace by their marriages and alliances. They were those that provided hospitality and warmth, sometimes extending to the warmth and hospitality of their beds as well for honored guests. They had roles as mother, but as far as we know, they didn't have a role in the actual shaping of the stories.
Mm-hmm. But for those of you who are scholars of Beowulf, that didn't interfere with your appreciation of the story, and you found your own ways to express the feminine points of view by reaching out to the characters that you found there. Is that too much to say?
I was a little disturbed at first because they were bartered for power, and there was some female sacrifice at the burial of a king that was hair-raising. But, yeah, you can dig in and find them.
Yeah.
Portal of Real or Tale. I'm listening to stories of long ago. You appear. Someone or something whispers. A glimpse of the past opens through a portal, and a mixture of light and dark emerges. Glimmering shadows pass through lonely souls, tinting the lenses of the underworld in an illusion of warmth and rays of the sun. Pain, anger, and hissing can be heard from the sea. The misty glaciers shimmer in the distance, and the seawater rises high in the color of cloudy green. The sea witch can be seen riding on the crest of 10-foot waves. Although she longs for companionship, her sought-after lovers will only become corpses for the fish to nibble upon. Did they believe in a god or gods when the ocean's waters transformed to a being and rose up, pulling and sucking them into the flowing tides? Only to be resurrected later into megaliths, for distant men from another time to ponder what their fate may have been. Venture further south and closer inland, and the tales of the gloomy mystics and hybrid creatures related to who and from whom. The mother, the lover, the whore, the seducer of men, who live in the wild, gifted in seeing the future of death through the eyes of men, but not how their living days shall be endured. A moment of time is stopped, and the shadows move, and the portal closes. Their fate has been sealed to lie still beneath the sea, entombed in darkness, never to see or feel the warmth and rays of the sun. I awaken in a dreamy state, unable to distinguish what is real and what is tale. Catherine Hart. Images of Grendel appears. Listening to the drone of a speaker on how plasma flows through the heart, an image appears on the screen of Grendel. Who? Grendel. What? Had it not gone and fallen into a crevice when the earth was splitting and rumbling? Did it not become entombed in the hot lava that moved across the earth, sealing and hardening the exterior and gaps in between? In the inner flashing of the magnetic fields, someone crosses over, spreading masses of activity in the form of neuron surfaces. The being passes through the light of time and latches itself into the artery of a heart, pulsating through erratic movements and spasms of energy, flooding the heart to spin in and out of the universe. Stop! Who? Grendel? Where? Smeared and entwined in the heart, transformed in colors of bluish gray, purples and tendrils of okra. Grendel, smeared in negative space and massive energy. When the chaos and conflict began, who was coherent of Grendel's revolution? Grendel, unafraid of emotions and a likeness of being, dispenses an inner riot that pulsates through the heart. Who is aware of what happened, what occurred, the shifting and spiking of man's old reptilian brain, thereby leaving the mind open? No defense systems, no access for the higher intelligence of man to evolve. The heart is intuitive, but the mind is not. Unaware of the spirit that has entered him until it slaps him in the face to consciousness, who is the last to know of Grendel's existence? The heart. Be in touch with the heart and aware of the mind. The relationship depends on the two to formulate into one before the arrival of Grendel. Grendel, Grendel, Grendel.
My name is Rose Black. Beowulf explores troubling ethical and political questions which apply to our current times. And some of the things that have interested me are the hero's relationship to freedom, exploring the outcast, the repressed, individuality versus obligation to the group, youth and age, and most of all, hoarding versus generosity. This first piece I'm going to read is called Generosity, and it was inspired by Beowulf. Generosity. It had something to do with the man who made a lot of money, then gave it all away. When he was through giving away material things, he began to give away his time and volunteered everywhere. His wife got fed up and threatened to leave. One morning, the man left the house while his wife and children were still asleep. He drove to the hospital where he gave one of his kidneys to a stranger. "Why should I have two kidneys," he said, "when others don't even have one?" It had something to do with the man who climbed through her window in the middle of the night. "Take everything," she told him. "Please, take it all. If you take it all, there will be nothing left you could possibly want from me." It had something to do with being in a foreign country where she didn't know the language and no one knew hers. She was leading the others to safety, a bridge swinging high above a river. The people pushed forward, but when they all ran onto the bridge at once, the bridge cracked, then fell apart. It had something to do with the man who gave his kidney to a stranger, how the newspaper said that people were angry, thought he was a nut job, a giving addict, selfish. He should have saved the kidney for his kids. One of the things that I enjoyed most about Beowulf was the rich language and the sounds. And some of us in the class did what is called homophonic translation. And this is where we rely on word sounds, merely the sounds of the words, and then we do a faithless translation. So it becomes sort of a collaboration, a mix of Anglo-Saxon and our own subconscious thoughts. So interesting things come out. So this is one of my homophonic translations, which I call Four Songs from Beowulf, Faithless Translations from the Anglo-Saxon. Night gone forward. At the bottom, sea worms give in to meaty sway, an ear-bending churning of foam. This is what draws in the fools and the orphans, willing wrecks bereft of God. On the shore, the pear trees wither. The high walls of huff and the wheels of ambition swat the pony's west flank. The sea calls the callous cud. Huge papa is shredded. I am sick from white pears. The free can sell rants. Under the scope of their going, the elders genuflect. Gold wine and brittle palms are held steadfast, their offspring filled to the brim. The way holds dangers. The maps and the lotus can pound the ground wrong. The poets are full. The hound of winters holds on to the Russians. One man draws a bear, another sings on the beach. The stones are still standing, but the dragons hide near and will fight with fire and fangs. The firm help the helpless hide hordes. They hold on. Murders in the pond. After modes of mere performing, muscle means more. After murders in the pond, midway guards meander over gritty levees. What cunning! The dirge-like guilt of dolls drums in deep water. Are the drums nothing? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Patrice Warrender. I hadn't read Beowulf since high school, and I never had any real appreciation of it until I started studying it now, and everything about the poem interested me. The story itself, the concept of fate and destiny, but the sheer beauty of the language is what enthralled me and inspired my own writing. The embedded music in the poem and the evocative imagery. The next poem that I'm going to read relates to Beowulf in that it also is dealing with an epic time, and it uses the elements of Anglo-Saxon poetry, and including something called Ubi Sunt. Ubi Sunt asks the question, where are they? Where have all the flowers gone? It's a lamentation for something that is passing or has passed, and this is called Slipping Away. Nim the tide, thold time. Strangers knock on my door. They say the ice caps are melting. Winter frozen waxen, white foam on high. Crazed ice opens to dust stone and mud. Great halls splinter and fall into the sea. Blue mirror rising. Where go the giants that grow from the sea? Where the ice walker white bear? Where birds, sound of wings thrumming, the seal pups that blossom in spring, where silver wolf's night howl hunting, dree ice walker white bear slipping away, dree the tall sky empty, nim the tide, fold time, enow, fold up the earth, fugitive earth stepper slipping away.
Elsa Rossiger. And my intention for the piece that I wrote concerning Queen Wealthia was because I wanted to give voice to one of the female characters in the poem, and we don't hear much from them except maybe Grendel's mother. So I took a specific moment after all the stuff going on in the hall, where Beowulf promises to take care of Grendel, and later that evening, the queen writes a note or letter to a confidant about what it's like with this anticipation of what is to come, and all her hopes for what this person might do for them. A letter from Queen Wealthier to a confidant. My dearest one, finally the mead hall has settled down to what I fear will be uneasy sleep. But tonight something wondrous happened here in Heorot, and in these few quiet moments before I too must retire to my bed, I went to tell you of this miracle. I know the tales of our teen and trouble are told far and wide, of how the one they call Grendel comes out of the din at eventide, spreading his terror. He's a fearsome augur, they say, although any details of his appearance are sorely lacking. But now, with feverish anticipation, I shiver to think there may be a glimmer of hope, a possibility of release from these troubled times. A man has arrived. In the company of 14 warrior companions, he came sailing on the Swan Road to the east. Upon landing on our shores, he and his men were by our guardians quickly directed here to Heorot and soon seated with the king. After the usual formalities of lineage and kin, after tall tales of prow, after more than enough food and mead was consumed, I was at last summoned to join in the feast. By then they were a boisterous lot, a good shift that was, since nighttime has for long now been dreaded due to the bloody raids by Grendel. Nearly every night, someone has lost kin, and the king a leaf warrior. Beowulf is his name, this man from the land of Geats. He says he's come to rid our land of that monstrous Grendel, this Beowulf, stark and tall of stature and, like the Danes, fair of skin and hair. He claims to be the kin of kings. Indeed, he bears himself as should any jarl of kingly gree. His boasts are measured. This a welcome respite from the usual exaggerated tales of past feats in battle. In the spirit of kinship, I bade him and his companions a warm welcome to our house. They seem a cheerful throng, even though they even left their shields and spears stacked outside the hall, in itself an act of bravery and good intentions. Yet what stirred me the most was Beowulf's firm reassurances. He alone will meet the monster on the road of death, neither wearing mail nor used sword or spear. He promises a manly contest, a fight to the death. At first I took this talk to be another half-drunken would-be warrior's attempt to impress us, but underneath his words I perceived modesty and repose. I feel he knows that only after facing fear is it possible to triumph. At this time, when I grasp at straws to trust there can be freedom from this foul scourge, I heard in his words echoes of the old ways of doing battle with the dark powers. I feel it in my heart, I feel it in my bones, and I sense it in my memory of another time when such knowledge was our ways. So I entertain a wild hopefulness that I thought had vanished long ago. Maybe we can still be rescued from this fell Grendel and from our own deepest fears. My good lord is ready for his bed, and this night I will gladly lie by his side. Is your husband well, and your still young daughters? My own child are grown now. Two splendid young carls and a lovely maiden still live. I pray for us all.
My name is Donna Emerson. I was drawn to Beowulf for many reasons. I wanted to read the poem Beowulf again, since I hadn't seen it since high school. And I wanted to hear the beautiful music of the voice of Seamus Heaney with his translation in the words of everyday working people. I wanted to approach Beowulf as a poem, not a story. And having not heard the older English language, I wanted to play with those words again. And so the first poems I'll read are the ones of the mistranslations. And I will read the one first that Rose read first, just to show you how differently a piece of work can be mistranslated. Mine is called White Pears. Wonderful to say white. Hear sounds of horn-laden hoofs, listing gingerweed, then wade higher to nearby pear trees, while beside us seaweed sits slumped on holy wood. Its swan-like meter fills our ears with bending faith in the crossing of the nets. As dew falls on blossoms, night forces what we want. Something sips water wind. We see white pears. Another mistranslation I call whispers. Wonder light shines with whispers high. Nevertheless, night nears the steps. Citrus sits like nymphs beneath. Steeples stand here on beds straight up. Not running, near wires, white or full of color, and in the middle of a now, past heroes, reach, forge new words. He sings, remote, but coming nearer. With wonder lights, we pass through age. And now I'll read what we called raiding the word hoard. We looked at the Old English and made our own poems. And this is a very short poem I call A Ship to the Sun. Abaft
a lang, a sheen, my bairn dight, flasher in the fray in hand toward Gannett's bath. Carl, couth for his craft, goer on the sea to heaven's jewel. And the translation for that in our English is, aft, along, shining, my son prepared, gleaming sword in hand, toward the ocean, a man known for his craft, a ship to the sun. And then the last mistranslation I'll read is shorter. He winks as a refrain, waxing northwest, pining and pruning a peculiar headdress. As the poet vanishes, the bird he grapples, his hieroglyphics hooded in rangy theater, primarily sings peony songs for his dolor. Now I'd like to read my longer piece related to Grendel. In addition to studying Beowulf, we read John Gardner's book Grendel. And I, as a psychotherapist, was particularly drawn to the darkness that is in this book, indeed the darkness in both Beowulf and Grendel. I'm very interested in the dark side of the soul. I think we run from our dark sides. We put our dark sides onto other people, and we are determined in America to turn toward the light and the happy and the everything's fine. And I think this may be our undoing. Gardner had an affinity to Grendel, the monster who was the kin of Cain, and I think he can tell us a few lessons we need to learn. John Gardner grew up in the part of the country where I grew up, near Batavia, New York. And so I'm going to read the poem that I wrote called Grendel in Western New York, after Grendel by John Gardner. Poor Grendel's had an accident, he whispers. Grendel, Grendel, drinking again. Another young woman, another night, face down on the floor. Long before, in Batavia, farms filled the land as far as he could see, from Buffalo to Rochester. Church bells signaled the start of work, dinner at noon, and supper. April in his family fields, this season of short light, 11-year-old Grendel on the tractor couldn't see his brother fall off the cultipacker behind him. He could have put the brakes on when his sister screamed, but didn't. First he couldn't see, then he couldn't think. After his brother died, Grendel couldn't find his father. Looking, searching, he came upon him face down in the barn, screaming, crying. His mother locked herself into her bedroom. She bought Grendel and his sister a French horn and flute. She set the table with a place for her dead son, the missing one, every day of her life. These were rocky farms with poor soil, cold in winter, low-lying gray skies until the next storm tumbled in from Erie or Ontario. Grendel's father, a minister who ran off and wouldn't come home for weeks. Grendel knew about the farm wives his father visited. When his father was home on Sundays, he preached, sometimes reading his son's writings to the congregation. 6 feet of snow lasted until April. No forgiveness. Summer moved in late, hot, sticky, and fast. Hard drinking was what he did, in between the nightmares. Grendel wrote and wrote. He wrote a whole book about himself. He clumped around Geneseo County, then Broome County, not sleeping, taking women, raging. One arm torn off, he fled to his mother, wanting her to listen, but she was not there. He could only whisper to himself in blood shock, I killed my best friend. Grendel rode off, wrote his way off the farm, marrying, then destroying, then riding out, then marrying, then ruining, then riding out too fast, 4 days before his wedding, everything blurry, as it had been since he brought his brother down. No one there to talk to. Alcohol held him, his hair turning white, thrown off his motorcycle near the Susquehanna in the endless mountains. Grendel had an accident. He slipped on blood. So may you all. And last, I'd like to read a poem more personally about darkness in my own family. Certainly these pieces that we've been studying brings us close to our own darkness. This is called Doris Lucille in January. Mother told everyone in town, so we all knew she was born into her big family, born in the month of death and trying to forget, born the smallest, youngest, overlooked, always hungry. She fell out of the Model T going around the corner on two wheels by Shattuck's barn, rolling in dirt and dust. Tears streaming, not for the blood, stones in her knees, pulling herself to the ditch, but wondering if they'd come back for her. She became the beauty of the bunch, perfectly formed, smart as a whip, her father said. She mustn't put on airs, so he whipped her, and she had no airs. And later she whipped us, and we lashed out at each other, all cracked and able to be cornered, until we broke apart and left her house to find more air.
This is Susan Starbird, and I have an excerpt from the middle of John Gardner's novel, Grendel. In this scene, Grendel meets the dragon. That's not a scene that occurs in the epic poem, but it does in the novel. No use of a growl, a whoop, a roar in the presence of that beast. Vast, red-golden, huge tail coiled, limbs sprawled over his treasure hoard, eyes not fiery but cold as the memory of family deaths. Vanishing away across invisible floors, there were things of gold, gems, jewels, silver vessels the color of blood in the undulant dragon-red light. Arching above him, the ceiling and upper walls of his cave were alive with bats. The color of his sharp scales darkened and brightened as the dragon inhaled and exhaled slowly, drawing new air across his vast internal furnace. His razor-sharp tusks gleamed and glinted as if they too, like the mountain beneath him, were formed of precious stones and metals. My heart shook. His eyes stared straight at me. My knees and insides were so weak I had to drop down on all fours. His mouth opened slightly. Bits of flame escaped. "Ah, Grendel," he said, "you've come." The voice was startling, no rolling boom as I would have expected, but a voice that might have come from an old, old man. Louder, of course, but not much louder. "We've been expecting you," he said. He gave a nervous laugh like a miser caught at his counting. His eyes were heavy-lidded, minutely veined, wrinkled like an elderly mead drinker's. "Stand around the side, if you don't mind, boy," he said. "I get a cough sometimes, and it's terrible straight out front." The high dead eyelids wrinkled more, the corners of his mouth snaked up as he chuckled, sly, hardly hiding his malice. I quickly ducked around to the side. "Good boy," he said. He tipped his head, lowering an eye toward me. "Smart boy! He he he!" He lifted a wrinkled paw with man-length talons for nails and held it over my head as if to crush me with it, but he merely brought it down lightly, once, twice, three times, patting my head. "Well, speak, boy," he said. "Say, hello there, Mr. Dragon," he cackled. My throat convulsed, and I tried to get my breath to speak, but I couldn't. The dragon smiled, horrible, debauched, mouth limp and cracked, loose against the teeth as an ancient dog's. "Now you know how they feel when they see you, eh? Scared enough to pee in their pants, heh." He looked startled by an unpleasant thought, then cross. "You didn't, did you?" I shook my head. "Good," he said. "That's valuable stuff you're standing on. Boobies, hemorrhoids, boils, slaver. Now." He moved his head as if adjusting his flaking neck to a tight metal collar and put on what looked like, for him, a sober expression, like an old drunk preparing a solemn case for court. Then, as if involuntarily, he cackled again. It was horrible, horrible, obscene. He couldn't stop himself. He cackled so hard a brilliant tear like a giant diamond rolled down his cheek, and still he couldn't stop. He raised up the taloned paw and pointed at me. His head tipped back, laughing. He raised up the taloned paw and pointed at me. his head tipped back, laughing, blowing fire out his mouth and nostrils. He tried to say something, but the laughing got worse. He rolled over on his side, stretching up one vast, wrinkled wing for balance, covering his eyes with one claw, still pointing with the other, roaring with laughter and kicking a little with his two back feet. I felt cross all at once, though I didn't dare show it. "Like a rabbit," he brought out. "Nee-hee-hee, when you're scared, you look nee-hee-hee. Exactly, exactly." I scowled, and realizing I had my hands out in front of me like a rabbit sitting up, I jerked them behind my back. My scowl of rage nearly finished him. He hooted, gasped, sobbed, began to choke with laughter. I forgot myself completely. I snatched up an emerald the size of a fist and pulled it back to throw it at him. He was sober instantly. "Put it down," he said. He drew in breath and turned his huge head straight at me. I dropped it and fought to keep my bowels from moving down. "Don't touch," he said. The old man's voice was as terrible now as the eyes. It was as if he'd been dead for 1,000 years. "Never, never, never touch my things," he said. Flame came out with the words and singed the hair on my belly and legs. I nodded, trembling all over. "Good," he said. He stared at me a moment longer, then slowly, slowly turned his head away. Then, old womanish, as if he were, though still spiteful, slightly embarrassed, he got back up onto his treasure pile, stretched out his wings, and settled. I have another piece. It's a trilogy. It's two parts that are sort of normal, and then a middle part is, like, really snarly. Ursel in Midwinter. "Dearest Holga, my brother, many months have passed since you offered me, midsummer, beneath a blossom bower, to wed my new king, Onela. The time has passed well enow. Fortunes and forests, fish and fruit, feed the people of this kingdom. Yet a cold wind blows across my land, a wind no gold can warm. News of Hrothgar's mighty army has reached this fair realm. All Onela land is on alert. My lord can know no comfort. Even in our tender bedchamber, I cannot unlock his breast hoard. And the links our families forged in marriage are taut and brittle, though I be with child. Our father's ring I enclose, a token of our blood bond. Good brother, I beseech you, give it now to Hrothgar, and offer to him my blessings, and urge him, send diplomats, not warriors, lest next year's harvest be the blood of both our lands." Grendel's mother. "Aye, Grendel! Oh, grief! Kind, kith, kid, crawn and cracked, felled in dunder blood. Oh, ghastly act! Beastling is no more. Ow, Grendel! Oh, rage! Racked, reet, wretched, his wrecked corpse rocks in the womb of the sea. Oh, miserable hap! Mirkub is no more. Scorch with screams this craven cave house. Claw the sun from its accursed perch. Raise the rooks. Howl down the dark. From manger to mead coop rages a mother's revenge. The deed proud Danes dare rest no more." Wealtheow's Meditation. "What worth will my gold give if my kingdom's gone, its people ravished by wildings and warfare, none left to plant nor defend Hrothgar's Heorot? By my side sits my king, a man-bear once in battle, embittered now, brought to bay by a beast of darkness, a thirsty savage no thane can thwart. For 12 long years I've prayed for peace. Now comes here Beowulf, Odin's emissary. As you sit tween Hrethic and Hrothmund, I rise to greet you. As you sit tween Hrethic and Hrothmund, I rise to greet you. Our gold-helmed Geat-son, we trust in you to save our skins, to spare us our despair. Pray, slay the predator and bring us peace. Pray we shall not die in a barren land with none to build our barrow. Pray no harm befall the sons of Hrothgar.
Hi, my name is Maggie Tudor. I was drawn to study Beowulf because I felt that as a poet I ought to know something about Anglo-Saxon. But I really fell in love with Beowulf and with Grendel, the monster, and with the relationship between Grendel and his mother, who were really the last of the monsters. So my poem is called Grendel Ma, and it's spoken by the mother, and it's written partly in contemporary English and partly in Old English, with the idea being that even if you can't understand literally, that the sound will carry the meaning. Grendel Ma, I feared you'd go down the last of our kind, my Grendel barn, my leaf. But now, of a sudden, I couth, its eye will fade into the mold, life-weary, last of the large grunters, the voracious, fur-favored rompers. It's you who will die, the only one of your kind. My ladies roared in a world we deemed was made for us, joy of heaven shone for us, hue drunken flowers, grasses that made visible the wind. The lesser warmbloods even, there for our play and our devouring, we lorded it all as it listed us, all ours to lord. Then they came a sheen, the naked ten-fingered over the bowl of the mane. We creatures they were of daring do, but ours to bless, to scatter them, swallow them down. Yet they bore on their breath some eldritch force. Invisible, we were stricken from inside. Our food came back up our maws, our hair fell out, our muscles withered. Our starkest fed the fold with their blood. Some few survived, I among them. We won the deep caves to Dreatin, we could not wot. Here I bore you, hight you my Grendel, as the last fairies died off, leaving us two to our separate weirds. There was naught in my breast hoard to boot you wot this loath life. I fell into my own wan hope, growling and groping, trying to grok you, I beat my brow against the weedy walls of our water cave. You ransacked the word hordes of the settlers, their bard's song, strumming of strings, what the king murmured to his queen, the priest to his god. Not that it protected them, not even from you, my Grendel. You driven into crazy solitude by my gibberish and their dreams. You pull at me and flee me, vainglorious boy ogre, yammering to yourself with unwinding noise from the word hoard of the naked ones, sounding echoes across our lair, twisting and stretching in my ears, they push me from you as sure as your own paws cast me down. Today I let you leave the stead without struggle. In Graham I watch you go. The carles see in you only a troll. Eftsoon they will pierce you with their flashers in the fray. Somewhere you call out one more time, Mama, I'm dying. I have not the words for answering. My dumbness betrays you. You, the solitary, the only one of your kind. My tongue flails helpless in my mouth. Ach, ach, ach. Grendel Barn, my stranger, my son.
We've been listening to Terry Arrett and the Beowulf scholars, the Beowulfians, discussing that ancient epic and shedding light on the story. And I hope you're as excited as I am at the opportunities that we have now to go back to the story of Beowulf and get some meaning from it. And so this is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. Thank you so much, Terry.
Rosemary, thank you.
Yes. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.